site as well, and you can make a donation, and we use 100% of that money for food and supplies. For we gave away school supplies last month to dozens of children. All of that comes from the support we get from the community as well as out of our own pockets. So aaprporgan.org, there's a tab for the free breakfast program, and you can support, and we thank you very much. We're an independent revolutionary party though, so we can't get you anything from Uncle Sam, but we appreciate your support.
And thanks so much for being here. That's it for our
Thank
show.
You.
Check out Portland's All African People's Revolutionary Party work again at aaprporgan.org. And stay tuned for Political Perspectives.
Comes a time when every second, every day, when every action, every thought will tell the world how you cast your vote.
Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Imperialism, Climate Crisis, and Struggle, an evening with Harsha Walia and Luz Rivera on Sunday, November 8th at 5 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. Harsha and Luz will speak about their work and experiences cultivating fierce, loving, and sustainable communities of resistance within a transnational analysis of capitalism, settler colonialism, state building, and racialized empire, and how climate change threatens to or is already compounding the forces of state and corporate violence against which they struggle. Again, that's Imperialism, Climate Crisis, and Struggle, an evening with Harsha Walia and Luz Rivera on Sunday, November 8th at 5 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, 1011 Southwest 12th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Cable Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Voices in Action, Human Rights on Film, a series sponsored by Northwest Film Center. October 2nd through November 5th are the dates. While cinema provides entertainment and escape for many committed filmmakers and viewers, it's a vital medium of engagement and a powerful tool for social action. Films in the series include 50 Feet from Syria, Dreamcatcher, No Land's Song, and We Come as Friends. Again, that's Voices in Action, Human Rights on Film, from October 2nd to November 5th at the Northwest Film Center in the Whitzel Auditorium of the Portland Art Museum, located at 1219 Southwest Park Avenue here in Portland. More information about films and screening times can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And this is KBOO Portland. The time is 9:03 a.m. Coming up, we speak with Graham Russell of Rights Action about how policies and actions of the Global North negatively impact communities in Central America. At 10 on Flashpoints, an in-depth look at how the U.S. Pentagon uses NGOs for spying, covert action, and intelligence gathering. Also a close look at proactive incursion of the U.S. destroyer Larsen in the South China Sea. And satire from resident satirist Randy Credico. And at 11, the Radio Zine features a panel discussion on rising up and stopping LNG projects in Oregon, projects which would create liquefied natural gas terminals and build pipelines through our forests, under our rivers and watersheds, and across private farms and fields. How is it we can do all this? Because of the members of the KBOO Foundation and their generous support. If that does not include you, you can remedy that oversight at kboo.fm. Just click where it says donate today. Mr. Russell?
For political perspectives, I'm speaking with Graham Russell of Rights Action, a U.S. and Canadian-based human rights organization that provides direct funds to and does solidarity work with grassroots Indigenous and non-Indigenous community organizations in Central America and Mexico. He is on a human rights speaking tour in the Pacific Northwest through November 6th. He has lived in Mexico and Central America, working with grassroots organizations and NGOs on environment, development, and human rights issues. He has been featured in documentary films such as Gold Fever and Defensors, and he has published articles in a variety of venues. He is the author of The Never Ending, There Is Only One People Here. Graham Russell, thanks very much for making time to come to KBOO today.
No, it's a real pleasure to be here at your station.
Now, briefly, tell us a little bit more about what Rights Action does, if you would.
Rights Action does, I suppose, two or three main things. I've been running it for 20 years now. And the first thing is we raise funds in Canada and the United States. We're a tax charitable organization in both countries. So we get funds from private foundations and individual donors. And we directly fund community-based organizations, mainly in Honduras and Guatemala, little bits in El Salvador, some in southern Mexico. We directly fund community-based organizations that are implementing their own community defense struggles, human rights defense struggles, and environmental defense struggles, in summary. So getting funds into the hands of people who are on the front line of defending their well-being is a huge element of our work. The other two elements sort of combine. One is critical education and the other is advocacy. And in our education and advocacy work, we focus pretty much all of our attention on how the United States and Canada are often part of the problem when addressing the issues of poverty and exploitation, repression, environmental harm, etc., in countries like Guatemala and Honduras. So we bring North American delegations down, university groups, community groups, religious-based groups, on fact-finding delegations so people can learn firsthand, traveling around and visiting with communities that are involved in these community defense struggles. And then we focus our attention on how it might be a Canadian mining company that's creating the harms. It might be a hydroelectric dam funded by an American company. It might be people who have suffered repression because the United States is supporting military regimes in these countries, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we do our education and advocacy work focused on how we in Canada and the United States are often part of the problem, and that we, if we're concerned about these issues, we need to bring about change here as well.
And so your particular role involves sort of overseeing, or what is your role involved?
Rights Action is at this point in time a one-person organization. At different times over the last 20 years, we've had up to two staff in Canada and the United States, and four or five based out of an office in Guatemala. At this point, we're one full-time staff. So I'm a jack of all trades in the organization. It's a very small operation, but it works at this level. Mm-hmm. If I keep the overhead small, if I'm the one main staff, it keeps it small, but very functional.
And how did you get into it?
Just as I was starting my undergrad in my early 20s, I traveled to Mexico back in the early 80s and got pretty much a very transformative trip, being so exposed to so much poverty and contrasting it with the life I'd led in growing up in Toronto, Canada. And that sort of put me on a different path. I started exploring what is this whole phenomena that I haven't been exposed to. And then within a couple of years, I started going to Nicaragua in the mid-80s and getting very involved in the Central American Solidarity Movement that was spreading across the United States and Canada, trying to support Central American struggles for human rights and to put an end to the military-backed regimes supported by the United States. So the whole path started from there.
As you mentioned, you are promoting awareness of policies and actions of the Global North that negatively impact local communities in Central America. Can you give us maybe a general overview of how these are impacting Central America, and then we can maybe get into some more specifics.
Perhaps the elephant in the room is the generations of U.S. United States military interventions, or generations of United States supporting military-backed regimes, military regimes in countries like Honduras and Guatemala, and one could also talk about El Salvador, Nicaragua, just to focus on Central America itself. And those relationships between the U.S. government and the U.S. military with what I would consider to be fundamentally military-backed regimes in power now in Honduras and Guatemala hasn't changed. Many listeners might know that some of the very worst years of atrocities were in the 70s and 80s and into the early 90s. And that's true. The levels of outright massacres and killings has gone down considerably. But the structures of those societies have changed very little. And the U.S. militarily is still, politically militarily, is still playing a very strong and negative role in that sense. Then you can flip over to, let's say, the economic side and look at so many examples of the global economic order. There's been a wave of mining companies that have entered into Central America from the 90s forward. A majority of the companies are Canadian, a lot of them are American, and many of them are Canadian-American companies. And as Central America was supposedly transitioning away from the civil war conflicts of the 80s that the United States was involved with militarily, at the same time, these regimes in power were handing out ill-gotten and illegal concessions to foreign mining companies. So Rights Action were directly involved in supporting five or six different communities in Honduras and Guatemala whose entire well-being is being devastated by these mining companies. And I could go on at length about the range of harms and violations that are occurring. One can look at the industry of the production of African palm trees. There's been a huge spike in the production of African palm and sugarcane to produce biodiesel fuel and ethanol, because we consumers of fossil fuels in the north are trying to slowly wean ourselves from using fossil fuels, but we don't want to use less energy. And so there's been a massive increase in the production of African palm trees and sugarcane that serve to produce ethanol and biodiesel fuel. The violations are the same on the ground. There's widespread forced evictions of indigenous and campesino communities occurring in Honduras and Guatemala, let alone elsewhere in Latin America or Africa. And there's widespread repression against these people. And then the environmental impacts of this type of monoculture are devastating. I'll quickly go through. There's a tourism industry phenomena. Global tourism industry on the north coast of Honduras is forcibly evicting the indigenous Garifuna people that live on the north coast of Honduras, who've lived there for over 200 years. They are the original peoples of these lands. They are the owners of these lands. They are being pushed aside through corruption and outright repression to make way for private Canadian and American tourist operators, for large-scale five-star hotels with golf courts and tennis courts and swimming pools, all to cater to the global, i.e. North American, European tourism markets. And you can go on and on and on. Most of the struggles that we're involved with in Central America and have to do with the functioning of the global economy, mining, hydroelectric dams, African palm, sugarcane, tourism, etc. Mm-hmm. So our role is A, directly fund the communities that are suffering the harms and trying to defend their well-being, and B, educate North Americans about how these are our problems. We are the consumers. We are the investors. These are our companies. These are our free trade agreements promoting this type of quote-unquote development.
I want to get into some of the ways that your organization is dealing with those problems that you mentioned. But I wanted to, if possible, ask you about the refugee crisis, because that's so much, well, it's not on the forefront in this country, particularly right now, compared to what we've heard about the crisis in Europe. So I wanted to get some information from you about it. First of all, what is the extent of it, and why don't we hear that much about it?
That is sort of the main theme of this tour. Like, I'm talking about all the issues that we've already addressed, but the main sort of title of the tour in most universities is, why are so many Central Americans and Mexicans fleeing their home countries decade after decade? And last year in 2014, there was a considerable amount of tension in the U.S. Before the Syrian refugee crisis blew out onto our conscience and because of the role of the media. But last year, in mid-2014, there was considerable attention paid to the never-ending flight of Central Americans and Mexicans coming, trying to get through Mexico and into the U.S. And that got a fair bit of attention. There's three, to simplify things, there's three responses. One is they're all illegals, kick them out, send them home. Second response is they must at a bare minimum be treated with dignity and humanity, and they must at a bare minimum be treated with some sort of due process, legal process. Clearly, I favor the second position. The third issue that doesn't get addressed, and this is where the role of groups like Rights Action comes into play, is we need to critically look at our government public policies and our private sector policies that are contributing to and benefiting from the very causes that people are fleeing. This is part of the debate that we need to have much more of. Clearly, we need to treat them properly, legally, etc. And there's many groups across the U.S. bravely taking on that battle and trying to bring a sense of decency and humanity to the issue of these people who have fled very violent, repressive conditions. And I've outlined it a bit. But at it sooner or later, we're going to have to take the further step and say, what are the policies that American and Canadian governments and our companies are implementing? What is the role of the U.S. military that's creating the conditions that these people are fleeing? Or else we stay in this closed circle. Right. We are actually contributing to and sometimes benefiting from the very conditions that people are forced to flee from. And then when they get to our borders, we throw up our hands and say, why are you all fleeing here? Go home. And it's a perfectly brutal closed circle. And then just to finish off this point, into all this mix, you have to throw the war on drugs. The war on drugs has been is not the cause of the underlying reasons why people are fleeing these countries. It's contributed to an extraordinary worsening of all the conditions of poverty, violence, repression, corruption, and impunity that people have been fleeing decade after decade. The war on drugs is once again a very American problem. And so we need to talk about the war on drugs and how it's contributing to why so many people are fleeing north.
Yeah, I was reading an article. I think the woman was from Honduras, and she had to leave because there were some drug-related gangs that just dominated their whole existence there, and she was literally fleeing violence.
Oh, without question. These conversations get thicker and more convoluted before they get simpler. Honduras today has the highest murder rates in the world, has the highest levels of violence in the world in a country that's not experiencing a full-on war, like Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, etc. And that's depressingly stunning. But all of it is due to a military coup that took place in 2009 in Honduras. And this military coup was fundamentally backed and supported by the governments of the United States and Canada. Just briefly on Honduras, it was not some paradise of democracy and rule of law before the military coup. It had weak institutions, very high levels of exploitation and poverty. But they had a government in place dominated by an oligarchic president, Mel Zelaya, who comes from the oligarchy, who was trying to take some very, very minimal small steps towards addressing some of the gaping problems of poverty, environmental harm caused by mining companies, etc. Minimal changes were not permitted by the Honduran oligarchy. So the economic elites in Honduras, combined with the hierarchy of the military, got the okay with a wink or a nod from Canada and the United States, ousted the democratically elected, and since then, Honduras, from 2009 through till today, is dominated by an illegitimate military-backed regime. And the levels of violence and repression have spiked out the roof. They couldn't have planned a worse scenario in the short term for Honduras. Those are the reasons why so many people are fleeing, and the war on drugs and all the narco trafficking is one serious contributing factor.
What's your view on the current situation for those people when they get the ones that make it here?
Well, that's the other side of the work that I don't work directly on. Mm-hmm. I work very much on these issues, but supporting communities in the southern end who are struggling to defend their well-being, their way of life, their local watershed, their community well-being, so that they don't have to flee. So I work on that end of the problem. I know that in the U.S., though I don't work directly on it, there's just so many amazing groups, solidarity groups, Latino groups, legal groups, legal aid clinics, all across the United States, in the border areas, in especially in the large cities and states where there's huge concentrations of Latinos, that are working on this. Mm-hmm. And so, as I said at the outset, in very general terms, I am at a bare minimum in favor of treating every one of them humanely and absolutely legally as possible. These are not criminals. They should be considered, without getting into the legal niceties of the legal definitions, precise legal definitions of what is a refugee, they're fundamentally refugees. They are fleeing devastating situations with no end in sight. And the countries where most of the Central America, of the people are fleeing from, are Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, and Mexico. Mexico is we haven't talked about it yet, and Rights Action only works a little bits in the south and states of Chiapas and Oaxaca. The war on drugs has turned Mexico, living in many parts of Mexico, into a nightmare of violence and impunity and corruption and repression, and that falls clearly on policy decisions taken in the United States. The responsibility falls also on the Mexican authorities, but there's such profound levels of corruption between the narco-trafficking cartels in Mexico, intertwined with corrupted politicians, corrupted judiciary, corrupted military, corrupted police. The whole thing is a cauldron of money corruption and weapons and violence, and the United States is contributing directly to it. And so people are fleeing Mexico in probably in equal numbers that they're fleeing Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador.
And I was actually reading that, I guess there's been some information from the government, the U.S. government, saying, oh, the rate of people coming here from Central America as refugees, has families particularly, has really lowered recently. But the article that I read attributed that to them being stuck in Mexico, that was happening. I don't know.
No, there is, and it's a brutal short-term measure. I wouldn't even remotely refer to it as a short-term solution, because it's no solution to the underlying causes of these problems that we're talking about whatsoever. And just to hammer away at that point, the governments of Canada and the United States are not changing our political, economic, or military policies towards Mexico, Honduras, or Guatemala one iota. So even as we're trying to figure out what to do with the migrants and the refugees, we're not changing how we're contributing to the underlying causes. So then move forward. Crisis in 2014, it's all over the news, what to do. And then politicians in the United States say in 2015, oh, phew, the numbers are going down. It's really working. The brutal short-term measure is that the United States is pumping even more taxpayer money into Mexican migration authorities, leaving aside the drug enforcement authorities that we're also sending our tax money to Mexican migration control authorities. And they're the ones that are using very brutal, violent tactics from the south of Mexico to the north in Mexico to stop the flow of migrants, whether they're Mexican migrants or Central American migrants. And thankfully, there's been some very good reporting on those issues. But that short-term measure, which is brutal and violatory of so many human rights, will not resolve the underlying problems one iota. The migrants will keep on fleeing north.
I'm speaking with Graham Russell of Rights Action, U.S. and Canadian-based human rights organization. I wanted to have you give us some more information on some of the programs that you started to tell us about before that Rights Action does. You talked about the tourism specifically and the, what is it, the Garifuna people. How can we support people there as U.S. citizens or as Canadian citizens, and how does that work with the work that you're doing?
Rights Action is one small organization, and When I talk about particular community-based struggles that we're involved with, those are ones that we're directly involved with, providing them with direct funding, and then the North-South education and activism that we're referring to. So anyone who's listening to this program can easily get more information about Rights Action, get on our listserv, get on our Facebook, and learn more about and possibly support these particular struggles. My purpose coming here today is not that so much as to debate the broader issues and to try and make the connections between Canadian-American government policy, military policy, private sector policy, and how we're contributing to and benefiting from the very factors that are causing so many people to flee. The situation of tourism with the Garifuna people on the north coast of Honduras is just one example of an unjust industry, the tourism industry, being forcibly imposed on people whose lands belong to them. They're being forced off their land through violence. And where do they go? They flee. Many of them flee where to? The north. So it's just one more example of the same thing. Rights Action is not the only organization in Canada or the United States that's working on these issues. So I clearly invite any listener to go to our website, rightsaction.org, get on our listserv, become a supporter, etc. Mm-hmm. But hopefully what a conversation like this does is contribute to the broader debates as what is our responsibility when dealing with the fact that there's hundreds of thousands of people walking north right now as you and I chat on the radio trying to get into the U.S. There's hundreds of thousands more planning their trip north. And in the U.S., we have millions of people whose legal status is totally confusing and unclear. Those are very big issues to resolve, and we better resolve them keeping in mind that we're part of the underlying problem and that we have some sort of duty and responsibility to these people to treat them fairly and justly and legally inside the United States.
It's a lot more than maybe somebody deciding, oh, I'm not going to become a tourist in Central America at a five-star hotel that displaced people. It's more getting involved in interacting with the government to try to change the policies of the U.S.
I think in the long term, folks can get involved in these issues through groups like, directly get involved in these issues through groups like Rights Action or Witness for Peace or NISQA, the Guatemalan Human Rights Commission, or CISPIS in El Salvador, and many other groups that are just slipping my mind at this mm-hmm. particular moment. So yes, there's a role for people to get directly involved in Central America with organizations such as ours, come on fact-finding trips, educational delegations, etc. But sooner or later, I think one of the underlying challenges we have is to first talk about and understand how our policies contribute to these issues, and then bring about change here in the north, whether it's dealing with an example such as the global tourism industry and its impacts on the Garifuna people, or how we end up treating hundreds of thousands of people who are forced to flee north every year. Those are all of the above is very important work to be involved with. Most of that work needs to be done here in the United States or in Canada as well, to a lesser degree. There's many organizations working on these issues and many ways to get involved.
Can you talk a little about the Honduras pro-democracy movement?
Yeah, very moving, very complicated, in very repressive situation. So what happened was, in June of 2009, the military elites and the economic elites colluded, and pretty much it's almost an open secret that they got the okay from the U.S. State Department that was headed by Hillary Clinton, and clearly got the okay from the president that the U.S. government wasn't going to do anything about this, and they ousted the democratically elected government of Mel Zelaya. And as I was saying earlier, the government of Mel Zelaya was in no way some progressive radicals government, but it was bringing about small, tiny measures of change. And even that was too much for the ideological elites, the economic elites. What I think the elites in Honduras did not foresee, and certainly in Canada and the United States, because both of our governments are the ones that most supported the coup and the post-coup regimes, and we have a huge amount of responsibility in that regard. What none of these sectors foresaw was the extraordinary outpouring of protest, popular protest. If Honduras had been Syria or Iran, We would have had all the corporate media down there in droves. There was all through 2009, all through 2010, there was hundreds of thousands of people regularly in the streets marching, being confronted with tear gas, rubber bullets, live bullets sometimes, riot cops with you know, all the RoboCop equipment on, hitting them with batons. And they still kept on marching. And it wasn't just young student activists. It was grandmothers and grandfathers and new parents with their kids in strollers. They were so outraged that once again, the elites had overthrown a democratically elected government supported by Canada and the United States. And out of that grew the National Resistance Front, the Frente Nacional de Resistencia. Amazing movement. There's been all kinds of complications keeping it together. The biggest complication keeping it together is that the regime in power in Honduras has responded with extraordinary levels of repression. And it's very hard to keep a movement intact when your leaders are, when student activists, women activists, indigenous activists, union rights people are being targeted for killing and being assassinated. And then in one of the rounds of elections, they formed sort of an alternative, more progressive party called Libre. And Libre members started being targeted for assassination. So leading up to these terribly undemocratic elections a few years ago, 20 Libre members, party members, were assassinated. So the level of repression that the government is using in Honduras is extraordinarily high. Notwithstanding that, the resistance movement continues, as do courageous movements across the country to try and bring an end to this sort of U.S. and Canadian-backed nightmare.
Yeah, I was going to ask you what the current status of that movement is. And
well, it's weakened, but it's weakened perhaps as a national movement, but all across the country, there's still all these local movements. The Garifuna people are not just against imposed tourism industries, they're against this unjust regime. The Lenca people in the western part of the region are not just against illegal logging and hydroelectric dams that are arriving in their region in droves, they're against this unjust regime and its partnerships with global businesses. In the Aguan region of northern Honduras, where there's massive production of African palm, and it's become the most violent region in all of Honduras since the coup, they're not just defending, trying to stay on their land so that they're not forcibly evicted by the wealthy landowners, but they're against this regime in power that's facilitating all this, and they're against the World Bank that's investing in this production of African palm, and on and on and on across the country. Mm-hmm. Incredibly courageous grassroots movements exist everywhere. That it can come together and coalesce into one smoothly functioning national movement is always complicated when there's such high levels of poverty and violence. But they go forward at great risk to themselves, but they go forward. And there is a growing network in Canada and the United States, the Honduras Solidarity Network, that is bringing together many different groups, like Rights Action's a member of it, and many other groups are a member of it. And so there is, to the best of our abilities, there is a bit of a concerted response in Canada and the United States, A, to shine a light on how our governments are part of this problem, and B, to shine a light and support the people on the ground in Honduras. So against great odds, we're all doing our best.
Can you talk about the Guatemala Justice for Genocide movement and what that involves?
Every one of these sort of struggles that you ask about are all gloriously amazing in their own right. I could spend hours talking about the Garifuna people and what they're, who they are as a people and what they're trying to defend as a way of life. The people in the Iguan resisting this devastation by the World Bank and the African palm producers. The Justice for Genocide struggle in Guatemala is mind-bogglingly courageous and glorious and very difficult. And Guatemala, like Honduras, is still dominated by the military elites that were in power during the genocide. In the elite sectors of Guatemalan society, there's a very high degree of genocide denial. All of the political elites that are in power now, the military elites, are genocide deniers. They absolutely deny what happened in the country. They still default back to, this was a hard civil war and we fought the communists and we won, and yes, some mistakes were made. And every international human rights organization and national organization has found otherwise. There's no doubt that U.S.-backed genocides were committed in Guatemala. And the U.S. didn't even just play a casual little role. The U.S. should be a co-defendant in the genocide trials in Guatemala for the role it played directly and indirectly. And I could go on for a few hours about that. But meanwhile, even though Guatemala is characterized by extremely high levels of a lack of democracy, high levels of impunity, i.e. the legal system fundamentally is weak at best or dominated by the powerful sectors, they've been pushing forward this extraordinary genocide trial in Guatemalan courts. The roots of it go back to the 90s when they first started digging up the mass graves and exposing the evidence of genocide. And over the 90s and into all through the 2000s, it coalesced into these very well-crafted legal criminal charges laid against two different military regimes, one headed by Lucas Garcia, one headed by Rios Montt. And there's many chapters to this process, but it all came together in May of 2013 when a Guatemalan court properly found that General Rios Montt was guilty of the crime of genocide. Legally, it's a very sound case. Legally, politically, it's unique in perhaps global history, but certainly in Latin American history, that such a high-ranking military officer was found guilty of being the intellectual author of this most enormous of crimes, genocide. Soon after that, the Constitutional Court in Guatemala, deeply embedded with the political, military, and economic elites, overturned the guilty verdict in part. This wasn't that surprising to people in Guatemala, but it was always a setback for sure. And so, legally speaking, today, people still celebrate the guilty verdict. Even though the corrupted legal system has sort of annulled it in part, the people who work on human rights in Guatemala and internationally, we all see that as a valid, legally binding decision and in a corrupted country. Having said that, all of the victims, the surviving victims who gave testimony in that trial, are still participating in the case today. Rios Montt, the general who was found guilty, is getting older and older. Most likely he will die first before there's ever a chance to find him finally guilty again, because basically the corrupted constitutional court sent it back to a certain point in the trial, so they had to start part of the trial all over again. And the activist human rights groups, their solidarity supporters, and the victims groups are all willing and able. They'll keep fighting that genocide trial for decades to come if necessary. And it's playing itself out as you and I speak. There's no end to it right now. It's an open trial. Meanwhile, what we really need to do in the United States is really consider sort of legally and politically, what was the role of the United States in that genocide? What do we need to do in the United States politically and possibly legally one day to try and hold the United States legally accountable for being partially responsible, co-responsible for the genocide in Guatemala? That in some ways is a less violent but much more complicated struggle.
How would we get someone in government who had sympathy for these issues?
Well, there's certainly, and other U.S.-based groups and certainly Washington-based groups know more about who are the sympathetic members of Congress, who are the sympathetic senators, and who are sympathetic government officials. And there are some. So at every step of the way, even though I would think that the U.S. government in general and both the elected branch and the executive branch and the government are not sympathetic to what you're hearing from me on this program, and that's too bad, there's clearly some very strong allies in Congress, a few of them, strong allies in the Senate. Other groups based in Washington know those ins and outs better than I do with Rights Action. And so I don't know legally how this would happen in the U.S. to try and hold the United States responsible for its contribution, its role in the genocide in Guatemala. Probably would have to begin with some sort of congressional and or Senate hearings, or possibly the convening of a grand jury to investigate this. But before any of that could happen, there needs to be the political energy behind it of U.S. citizens and activist groups and church groups and religious groups, etc., to say, yes, here is a crime so atrocious in the annals of human history, it's genocide, as legally defined. This is a case where we really ought to pursue ourselves much further. It could happen. It's not likely in the near future, but right. It's clearly something that could happen if enough people saw the value in it.
Graham Russell, we're coming to the end of the interview. What would you want to say that maybe we haven't said, or maybe you want to emphasize about what we've been talking about?
I think it's connecting the dots, if I could leave one thought. I think for many of your listeners, much of what I said is not new, depending on your who is your audience. But I say anyone who's worked on Central American solidarity issues is going to sort of agree with and find familiar in whole or in part what I've been talking about. These are not new stories, and these are not new issues. I think what I've learned over the last 25 and 30 years of being involved in this type of work is that one of our underlying challenges is to always figure out how to connect the dots between the local and the global. And that these are the migrancy issue, the refugee issue, is not to see it in isolation, that it needs to be dealt with. There's tens of thousands flooding north all the time. So yes, there needs to be a humanitarian short-term solution to that. And that debate is raging in the U.S. with one sector, they're illegals, throw the bums out. And then the other sector saying, no, treat them with dignity, treat them properly, legally. So you do have to deal with the short term, and that's a struggle. That's a battle going on right now. And thanks to all the people and groups that are working on those issues across the United States. But at the same time, we need to take our own whatever extra time we have to the next level and say, but at the same time, yes, we need to really critically look at our government policies, military policies, and economic policies, and the drug war that are creating the underlying conditions. Otherwise, this stuff just goes on and repeats itself. So it's the connecting the dots from the local to the global, connecting the dots from economics to politics to human rights, and throw in the drug war. It's a big, murky mess in many ways, and each one of us ends up working on a number of small pieces of it, but it's incumbent on us to try and understand it holistically, even as we're only working on, each person can only work on so many pieces of it. Because hopefully one day as humans, we transform how we live together inside our countries and between countries. Hopefully we transform how we live with respect to environmental harms and Mother Earth. And so connecting the dots is as much a bumper stick statement that you'll hear from me as any other in these types of discussions and debates.
I think that just keeping it in the public awareness is a big issue. I mean, even at a place like HABU, which deals with many human rights issues, trying to keep recognition that this is a problem that continues.
Well, it's a problem that continues, and yes, once keeping in the public eye is always a challenge. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that your radio station is very aware of that, and the whole role of trying to get this type of debate and discussion into the so-called mainstream or corporate media remains, as always, a very huge struggle. Mm-hmm. But we keep pushing away and chipping away at that as well.
Well, Graham Russell, I want to thank you very much for coming into KABU while you were in Portland, and make note that you will be in Oregon for the next week through the 6th, and you have a couple events in Eugene later next week, right?
Yes. On the Thursday night from 6 to 8 p.m. in Eugene, there's a public forum that's a presentation and a huge question and answer on the issues that you and I have been addressing. On the Friday night from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. is a presentation of the film, the award-winning film Gold Fever, that looks at the Canadian-American mining giant Goldcorp Inc. and the devastation that it's caused in Mayan Mam communities of Western Guatemala. But it looks at that dynamic, Goldcorp versus the Mayan Mam people, in the broad context of global economic issues and Guatemalan historical issues. And then there'll be a Q&A after that with myself. If folks are interested in those events in Eugene, they should email me at info at rightsaction.org, and I will just I'll send them the flyers, and perhaps I'll send you the flyer, the two flyers for those events here that you could share with folks.
Great. And for people who want to get more information on what we've been talking about in general, they can go to the website?
Yeah, at rightsaction.org, you can click all the buttons to join our listserv. You can find us on Facebook and be a friend and get all this information, or write me at info@rightsaction.org.
Thanks again. And let me tell people again, I've been speaking with Graham Russell of Rights Action, a U.S. and Canadian-based human rights organization. And as we mentioned, that's rightsaction.org. This is Kathleen Stevenson for Political Perspectives on KBOO Portland. If you missed this program or want to hear it again, it will be available on our website, kboo.fm, a little bit later today.
With a deterioration and lack of investment in the nation's public water supply delivery systems, more water disasters are in the headlines. From a chemical spill in a West Virginia river in January 2014 that affected 300,000 people, to the reports this month of serious contamination of the water in Flint, Michigan. More efforts are underway to privatize water that has historically been a public resource, both in the U.S. and around the world. At the same time, the growth in the sale of bottled water that consumers purchase on their own has accompanied and exacerbated the privatization trend. Corporate water privatization deals appeal to many cash-strapped cities and towns in need of costly infrastructure retrofits. But once in control of a vital public resource, corporations often use their monopoly to raise the cost of drinking water without public accountability. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Mary Grant, director of the Food and Water Watch Public Water for All campaign. Here she describes her group's work, promoting the protection and affordability of the nation's water supply by fighting privatization bids and advocating for increased federal investment.
Our Public Water for All campaign, we coordinate with local communities that are working to oppose the privatization of their water system, to support community efforts that are seeking public control of their water systems from private entities. And also we support water affordability programs.
It seems we're hearing more about water problems, from the disaster in West Virginia last year that affected 300,000 consumers, to news just this week that the water in Flint, Michigan is contaminated.
Yeah, so we do see increasing instances, or at least, I don't know if it's getting worse, but we're seeing more news about it, more concern about water quality problems, and our understanding of water quality contamination is getting better. So we know the health effects of contamination. So in communities like Flint, we were proud to work with What Are You Fighting For?, a local organization that was working to reconnect the city's water back to Detroit water. When they switched from Detroit water to Flint River water, and the community experienced serious problems with the water quality, in particular lead poisoning in their water, and then more children are having their high levels of lead in their blood. So that's a serious issue, and it's because of the corrosion in the pipes from the switch to Flint River water. It's more corrosive, and they didn't have the proper remediation chemicals included in the water. But we do see that this is an important issue. It remains an important issue. Since the founding of our organization, we've worked with communities working on fighting water privatization. They've reached out to us, and they need support to keep their water systems in local public hands. But what we're seeing as a growing problem is affordability. Federal funding for our water and sewer systems has been decreasing. Water quality standards are getting more stringent as we understand more about the contaminants in our water. And our climate is changing. So these factors are increasing the cost of infrastructure improvements that we need in order to provide safe water. So the issue becomes, how do you pay for it with federal funding dwindling? Rates are going up in communities across the country. Water rates are regressive. So they pose a disproportionate burden on low-income households. A solution that we see is having water affordability programs to address that issue of increasing water rates and regressive water bills. to ensure that everyone has access to safe and affordable water service.
Did you say that climate change is a contributing factor in these problems?
Yeah, climate change is an issue for many communities, especially coastal communities that are seeing rising water levels. There's more flood events. There's droughts, changing climate, extremes in weather events that are affecting our water utilities that people have to plan for and make improvement projects to plan for and to protect their water supplies.
Mary Grant, I've heard it said, and you know, this is at least partly by water companies themselves, who obviously have a vested interest, that water is the most undervalued of any of the utilities in America, and that in order to protect water quality and update infrastructure, water bills will naturally have to go up.
We think that water is priceless. It's invaluable. And so the water itself is a common resource. There is a cost to treating and distributing the water. And we want to make sure that those costs, that burden of those costs, are allocated equitably so that we're not overburdening low-income households. The intention of the affordability work that we're doing. But we also want to, ensure that all the money, all the revenue collected from water and sewer rates are going back into the system. We don't want to have profiting off of our water and sewer services. They're such essential services necessary for public health and well-being that we can't have money going out of the system.
Who exactly provides the water to communities?
I think 9 out of 10 people have water service from their local government. There are water companies, particularly in the Northeast, that these are investor-owned water companies in the Northeast that provide regional areas. So there are regional water companies, and then there are national water companies like American Water and Aqua America that serve mostly more rural communities, because there's rural communities and statewide in different states. And then we also have international, multinational water corporations like Suez and Veolia that are involved in water provision.
Isn't American Water the company responsible for the contamination disaster in West Virginia?
That was American Water. It's the largest water company in the United States. Oh, it's actually interesting. There's a local community group in West Virginia right now that are seeking local public control of their water system from American Water, in part because of the response they've seen to the water contamination that they think is inadequate, that the company responded poorly to the water contamination and didn't prepare for and plan for.
The fact that over the past 20 or 25 years, so many people have been convinced that bottled water is better, even though much of that just comes from public water supplies, there's very little oversight of the industry. How has that affected the whole situation of providing quality, affordable water to people?
That is a major concern, that there is this public perception that our tap water is unsafe, so people don't want to invest in it. And then who can afford bottled water? Maud Barlow talks about like a two-tier water system. You have people who can afford this bottled water, and you have people who, are stuck with tap water. And if you're not having the people who can afford bottled water invest in our tap water system, where does it leave our tap water system?
That was Mary Grant, director of the Food and Water Watch Public Water for All campaign. For more information on the group's work to ensure safe, affordable public water supplies, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The Pulitzer Prize-winning online news site InsideClimateNews.org has published a groundbreaking investigative report that revealed that ExxonMobil Corporation, the largest and most powerful oil company in the world, had known through its own cutting-edge scientific research that climate change presented a serious threat to the Earth's environment as early as the late 1970s. Despite that knowledge, Exxon spent more than two decades providing millions of dollars in funding to individuals and groups, promoting the myth that climate change was uncertain. The authors of the six-part series, titled Exxon, the Road Not Taken, using Exxon's own internal documents and citing interviews with former Exxon employees and federal officials, conclude that once the oil giant realized that government limits on the production of greenhouse gases would cut into its profits, it worked to sow doubt about the reality of global warming and lobbied to block federal and international regulations to control carbon emissions. Your reporter spoke with Jack Cushman, a reporter with Inside Climate News.
In the way that the Pentagon Papers illuminated the Vietnam War's realities when they were finally released, we thought, let's go back and see what we can find out from the earliest days of climate research. And so we started doing the things that investigative journalists do, going to records, going to archives, reading hearings, and finding people, interviewing people who were active in Exxon at the time. Exxon, of course, is and was the largest oil company, close to the largest oil company and one of the largest corporations in the world. And as it happened, we were kind of surprised to learn that Exxon alone among oil companies was very actively engaged in climate research in the 1970s. And we simply hadn't been aware of it, let alone of the character of the research they were doing, rigging an oil tanker to take actual ocean samples to see what the carbon flux was between the atmosphere and the ocean, and doing all kinds of imaginative research. They even proposed at one point getting 100 bottles of vintage French wine from back over the decades to see what radiocarbon isotopes of, were in the wine and help determine what part of the atmospheric carbon was coming from fossil fuels and what from other sources. And it was really quite extraordinary. And in fact, we used words to describe it like extraordinary, farsighted, ambitious, rigorous, a model of corporate responsibility, even altruistic. Now Exxon says we misrepresented them, but we're puzzled to find that they would think that was a misrepresentation. So in among these documents, here's what we found. Exxon was so closely engaged in the science that it clearly understood the emerging risks of climate change. We're not saying that they knew exactly what was going to happen for the next 30 years. Nobody did, and science is always uncertain. But they knew enough to know that the Earth was warming, that climate change was probably due in part to man-made emissions of fossil fuels, their product, that this was likely enough that as the temperatures continued to rise and the signal emerged from the noise, a point which has long since passed, governments would begin to take actions, and that based on the current understanding of the science, those actions would probably mean cutting down on the use of fossil fuels, hence an existential risk to Exxon. And this was spelled out in many ways, and in documents we went through hundreds of documents, we went through a lot of interviews, we went through other sources that are already on the record, and this was a little examined time, and we wanted to examine Exxon's subsequent record of influencing climate policy by muddying the science in the light of what they knew in the early days. And so as we looked at these documents, we found a very early briefing to the board, which explored all the uncertainties involved in the emergent state of climate change as of 1977, and which presented the conclusion, and it was in a long document, but as journalists, you pick up a document and you look for the summary. And so this document was a summary, an extensive summary of the, of a presentation to top management by a senior scientist. And the summary he wrote down in order to be able to share this much more broadly within the corporation. And it was, you know, a fairly detailed document of many pages. So under the word summary, that document presented its conclusion, and it said, in the first place, there's general scientific agreement that the most likely manner in which mankind is influencing the global climate is through carbon dioxide release from the burning of fossil fuels. And to us, that was a revelation. That was news. And so we took it from there, and what you have now is a six-part series of tens of thousands of words that goes into really extraordinary detail about Exxon's earliest engagement with climate science, and then a discussion of what's much better known, their decades of undermining the science.
What effect do you think is likely of your investigation on ExxonMobil, what they knew and what they didn't know about climate change? What effect do you think that'll have on the important meeting that's going to be taking place in Paris, France, at the UN Climate Summit this December?
Well, I think that in terms of the climate science, you know, the horse has gone from the barn at this point. This year, once again, is the warmest year ever recorded. So I don't think Exxon really has much chance of influencing the outcome these negotiations. The rest of the world's oil companies, by and large, are going to the negotiators and saying, we need certainty and we need an approach that gets us to the international targets. And Exxon and a handful of other mostly American oil companies are outside that group, but I think the tide is moving against them.
That was Jack Cushman, a reporter with InsideClimateNews.org. Find links to the group's six-part series titled Exxon, The Road Not Taken, and related information by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
Oh, yeah. Can you dig it? It's 9:59 a.m. on at KBOO in Portland. Oh, sorry, KBOO Portland in Portland, Oregon. It's a gray, wet, chilly morning out there, so crank up that space heater, stoke the wood-burning stove, and keep it locked right here on your community radio, where we've got Flashpoints coming up. Full hour. Air Cascade is taking the day off. Followed at 11 by the Radio Zine with a panel discussion on rising up and stopping LNG projects in Oregon. How on earth can we do all this? Seems no other major broadcast outlet can manage to do what we do. It's because we are accountable to no one but you, the listener. The whole listening audience, the whole community. That's why we bring information that is so vital to the community. Not information that polluters want you to know. We don't squash the information that polluters don't want you to know. We tell you what you tell us you need to know. KBOO Portland. Stay tuned for Flashpoints.